Good morning. Today is Tuesday, 19th of October. Joining us this morning, Yano Valakovic. Oh, you're wearing like Humboldt State, because I don't think you're an Oakland A's fan. Or is that Cal Poly?
So for the listeners out there, I'm actually wearing clothing, so that's a good move.
Yes.
That is a good move, and I am wearing a green sweater and a gold vest.
You haven't been found in an airport running around talking to people naked, huh?
No.
Okay.
So, no, I guess I didn't really think much about it, but could be. Go Jax. Why not?
Okay. So you got the book.
I got the book. I'm looking quickly here. Ever wonder why popcorn pops?
Yeah, heat expansion on the kernel.
Popcorn, a variety of Indian corn called Zia Mala Evarata, is different from ordinary corn in that it has a harder outer shell. As the corn is heated, moisture in the starchy grains is converted to steam, causing a tremendous pressure to be exerted against the shell. The tough shell stands up under the pressure for a while, but eventually breaks down, and the kernel explodes with such force that it throws out a white, pulpy inside, making an audible popping sound in the process. Harder outer shell. So?
So it's actually inside out corn.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, there we go.
There is a story going through the radio industry right now that one of the conservative talk show hosts that was put forth as a possible replacement for Rush after he died is refusing the vaccine. And the company, Cumulus, has said 100% or you're out of here. And he's one of their golden boys now.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a little bit of a brouhaha. Mm-hmm. Basically, a bluff is being called and one side's going to win. And mm-hmm. I mean, it'll be a win-lose, so it's not going to be a mediation in between. Mm-hmm. With some of the stuff that the governor is doing, are you under that edict? Or is the cooperative extension or state mm-hmm. education under mm-hmm. that same vaccine or leave at the UC level and the state universities?
Yeah, way to go for a nice softball opening question.
Well, it was top of mind. I'm still trying to listen to the podcast where you announced it, and I can't find this silly thing.
Yes, the University of California and the California State University System made a universal vaccine mandate quite a while ago.
Effective?
Beneffective.
Some time ago. Did you lose anybody at your staff?
I did. I lost 3 people. 3 out of 15. All millennials.
20% is pretty good.
All millennials.
Okay.
Not all the millennials were unvaccinated, but
right.
It was all millennials, and all for very different reasons. I think for the majority of them, it was convenience. It was a convenient reason to. It was a little nudge for something that had been brewing for a while, for the most part.
So it wasn't a reset of their career because of an external force.
More personal reasons. But, you know, this is going to sound controversial to the listeners out there, but we're a science-based organization, and it's an interesting litmus test of our commitment to science.
Yeah, there's a lot of yin and yangs with this one.
Yep.
In the healthcare community, too, with nurses.
Right. I mean, so we have options for those with religious objections and medical reasons, and those need to be verified and qualified, but, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suspect because somebody's overlooking your shoulder to make sure that you
but
get
in reality,
it right.
We're public-facing, and we have heavy interaction with the public in many ways, and we can't do our jobs very well if we can't do that effectively. We can't.
So what happened during the period when the office was closed? You guys would just go out in the field?
We were, it was heavily regulated, and everyone had to drive in their own vehicles, and it was complicated and expensive during that time period.
It was more costly to deliver service that in that model.
For my field crews, it was expensive for me because I couldn't put 2 people in the same vehicle, so I had to.
Well, you don't do the Caltrans work example, do you?
No. But my husband's forestry company was faced the same challenge early on in the pandemic, right? So we were suddenly sending lots of people in lots of separate vehicles to places, which was not necessarily the most efficient way of travel. But, I mean, what we did for the majority of our educational work was retool and deliver through online media And I think we've all gotten used to that. Do I think it's...
So you were a trendsetter then, rather than a trend follower.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I had a workshop that was 2 weeks after the lockdown, and we retooled the whole thing for online delivery, and it was interesting. In fact, maybe people won't find this interesting, but I had a 2.5-day workshop, and so I asked all the presenters to record their programming and then pushed it out a week in advance so people could watch the programming. And then what I created, because, you know, no one can sit through 2.5 days online. That's just ridiculous.
It's, well, I think you were right with your first reference, too.
So what we did is created basically dialogue sessions with the presenters. So you
like roundtable. You were doing the follow-up.
So in other words, you could go watch the recorded presentations, then go to a conversation and be live in that, and then you could go back and watch talks equally. Since we put them up on YouTube, we could see the user usage, and what was interesting is about half the audience seemed to watch them beforehand, and then half the audience seemed to watch them after. So people came to it in different places, and you know it's been a challenge for us, but a different style
and
learning.
Sounds a whole lot more effective.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I learn so much better from a live person. So,
well, but to have the Q&A follow-up and the roundtable discussions afterwards, but knowing that everybody's at least coming from the same point and you're not having to sit through boring PowerPoint presentations and the handouts and people some reading ahead and asking, well, on 14, well, we're on 3, you know, those types of things. I would think it would be a better experience for the attendees.
Maybe. I think we all learn differently. I think that's been the universal conversation, is that everybody learns in different ways, and we've generally been delivering for one style of learner
all along,
and so how do we accommodate?
Well, cut your food prices down, too. You don't have to have the donut bar followed by the fruit bar followed by the
sandwich
bar.
Yeah, but a lot of people come for the lunch.
Yeah, so your attendance might have been down a little bit, huh? were the reviews positive?
Reviews were generally positive in that we didn't cancel, because so many events got canceled in that early time.
So it was yes, no, rather than the degrees.
Yes.
Yeah. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Join Warren Eckstein on KINS in the 6 o'clock hour as he explains pet behaviors, different fun facts, tips, and all sorts of info about your animals and the way they think and act.
Here are just some of the things that kids learn when they have pets in their life.
If you're an animal lover, this is absolutely the program you need to hear.
You know, vocalizations are a very important part of animal communication and their language. Hi, this is Warren Eckstein. Hear my daily pet tip weekdays on KINS FM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Jana Valakovic. What?
I'm just laughing because I have no idea where this radio show is going to go, and I'm expecting some wild thing to get thrown at me.
No. With the fires and the damaged trees and stuff that have been going on this year, previous years, do you see this as an ongoing cycle? Yeah, I've seen some stuff, and it's kind of torquing me out. We've been in La Nina for a while, so dry, right? Now we're going to La Nina. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, it's going to be even worse. And it's like, wait a minute, guys. You can't have the full spectrum and be everything being bad. We're going to have this, and we're going to have... It's like, time out here. One of the things that we've talked about is... with the fires over the past little bit, is that it's so dry and the drought is so much, now that it appears as if, and a lot of folks are saying, in our part of the state, things are going to be wetter than normal. So the aquifers are going to be filled up. We don't have the drought situation. We've got snowpack in the hills and all these things that they've said have been leading contributors to these fires. probably are not going to be there next year. But then you keep hearing how bad it's going to be. And it's like, wait a minute. Help us understand what is coming out of the state's mouth here on some of this stuff.
Well, Brian, there's a lot in there. I mean, yes, weather has something to contribute to fires in or lack of fires or all those things. What I've been seeing from the Climate Prediction Center is that we're on the
Climate Prediction Center.
The Climate Prediction Center. There's
actually a center that.
Yeah. So if you go on
not
to
NOAA.
Yeah, if you go onto NOAA's website,
So
the National Weather Service, and you can get some nice graphics about what the weather's going to look like for the next week. If you go to the bottom of the page, there are, they call it climate, but there's monthly and seasonal outlooks, and then there's a climate prediction link. And so you can see in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, three months, you
project
know,
out
projector,
you want.
And right, yeah. and the way those maps look, they're like this. They cover the United States, and they have brown blobs, which means it's predicted to be drier than normal or warmer than normal, and then they have green ones, which say wetter than normal or equal chances. And so we get a lot of influence from the Pacific Northwest, and so sometimes those storms and that pattern slops down into Del Norte in particular, and sometimes Northern Humboldt, and sometimes all the way through.
About Cape Mendocino.
Somewhere in there. So we are sitting in that space where we could be slightly wetter than normal. But when you look at the climate prediction outlook for the United States, we're still in the drought prediction overall category. So it kind of
probably good news for the Southeast. the South with some of the issues with flooding they've been having.
Yeah. I mean, those are sort of hurricane related and other things. So I don't really know where we're likely to be.
Let's play it out.
Well, let's just play it out. So 6 months from now, we'll have a better understanding as to whether or not the snowpack came in or...
You know, that college degree really comes in handy for you, doesn't it?
I mean, you know, you can... But, I mean...
Let's say we're going into a wet cycle.
Sure.
Just for...
Kicks and giggles.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be great.
Kicks. I hadn't heard that one in there, but that's okay. Kicks and grins also? Sure. Okay. What does that look like then next spring?
Well, it looks great for us then because all of those, the live vegetation gets rehydrated and so does the dead logs and snags and all of the other stuff. So, I mean, that was some of the problem we had this year in that those logs that are on the forest floor never really got super hydrated. And so come June, they were still pretty dry.
Right.
And which means that they were able to be involved in, you know, if they had a fire exposure, they'd likely ignite, which increases the resistance to control and makes it harder to manage those fire events should they occur. But the bigger challenge and the part that I think we can control is sort of the fuel equation in the...
Oh, you can't read my writing. I was going to turn around. Forest practices.
Well, and I think that's... You know, that's
kind of what's come to the forefront, isn't it?
It's more than just, I mean, it's all of it, right? It's,
well, sure.
I think it's our whole paradigm towards fire. I mean, we really had this perception, I think, as a culture in California that we can, you know, until the last decade, that we could manage most wildfire incidences. Occasionally one would get a little out of hand, but for the most part, we had the suppression capacity to take care of those. And I think what we're, you know, coming to realize is that we have so much accumulated fuel, both live and dead, across California's landscapes, from chaparral to oak woodlands to our coniferous forests, that when you get an ignition, and if you get wind behind that, or you have multiple ignitions simultaneously in California, resources get spread thin, and it's, you know, it's a game changer. And
so let's go back to the 60s when there was more active logging, more cutting, there was salvage harvesting, so the fuel on the ground was a lot less. Was that better as far as if the goal was targeting or making it more difficult for these large forest fires to occur?
Let's go back a little farther first. And how much time do we have?
Oh, it's about half of our Nerf ball. So about 15.
So I think we should start closer to the period of the Gold Rush and think about what our landscape looked like then.
And we'll do that when we come back. KINS News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now,
Lars. Real Red Meat Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS. News and information time is 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Yana Valakovic from the UC Cooperative Extension. Spruce Point.
Spruce Point.
Are you using Spruce Point more often now as a geographic reference?
Always.
Good.
Yes. Everything. Always.
Us old timers got to keep something rolling, huh? Oh. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about what happens and what historically happened as far as forest fires and procedures and how they acted, and you'd said, let's go back to the Gold Rush time.
Right.
So I would say pre-development.
Well, okay, so what's interesting to me is when you look through tree ring data, so, you know, you can take a core of a tree and evaluate.
Tell how old it is.
Tell how old it is, but you can also see fire interactions, and so you can see that's how you get to the fire return.
Would that be the ash in the middle of the tree?
No, you'll see burn scars, and
okay,
and so you can see
some markings.
Right, yep. So it gives you a snapshot into the past, a long past, right? So there was a warming period in the 1700s where fire frequency didn't increase, even though it was a lot hotter and drier during that time period.
1 or 2 degrees? I mean, when you say a lot, what is...
I don't know what the actual number is, but it's called the medieval warming period. And what's interesting is that fire behavior didn't change significantly during that because the Native American community did a really good job of using fire as a tool and managing fuel conditions. So the point is that even during historic dry times, we've been able to manage these fuel issues to be able to... exist with fire in a more manageable way.
You're talking about some of the large fires that they would do to burn.
Well, so fire is
in the wet seasons.
Fire's always been a tool, a cultural tool, whether it's to enhance the grass species for range, whether it's to help support basketry and the condition of vegetation that makes it more pliable and easy to work with in a basket, or any number of reasons.
So they would set a fire, or they would enhance a lightning strike fire?
I don't know the full extent, but certainly fire has always been a tool, and it's been used and applied as a tool,
right. And
it did great work. So come fast...
They were able to control it, I guess, is
my point, though, is that when you look at the time of the Gold Rush and this sort of mass expansion of European Americans into California, what people encountered was a landscape with a lot less density of trees and a lot less fuel overall. And the one of our first challenges at that time was really, how do you get enough protein to support that whole group of settlers? And so it was early development of a livestock industry, and the settlers continued to burn to keep open lands for range conditions, so that there was grass for their developing herds of animals, their domesticated animals. But what strikes me is that you can read the historic accounts, and early fire crews were really just a person on a horse with a shovel.
Yeah, there was not a lot of water associated with them.
But my point is that you could be effective on a horse with a shovel because there wasn't so much fuel accumulated that you couldn't just knock things around.
So we're talking about land management now.
So early fire brigades were just really people on horses.
Right.
And could be quite effective. our eyes as settlers looked at that and said, well, there's a whole lot of waste going on here. And so we moved into this period of fire suppression with this idea that we could increase the productivity and the and not lose trees to fire. And really, we changed our viewpoint on fire as being something to be really to be controlled and to be something that was, you know, highly problematic towards our future production goals. And so what we've seen since then is basically the loss of that regular periodic fire that used to be part of the natural process, either through lightning or through land management issues by the Native American community. So then you add, as you were asking about, timber harvest and all of those kinds of things. But keep in mind that during the 50s and 60s, we were in a very cool period. There was a wet and cool period that happened during that time period. So we didn't have a collision during that land management period with sort of climatic issues. We kind of escaped that to some degree. So what we have now is all these, you know, that natural tending that fire did to consume fuels, to take out small trees, to, you know, keep grounds open, to keep, you know, rangelands open. We've lost all of that. And so now you have just accumulation of down logs, dead trees, young trees. You have, we call them fuel ladders or fire ladders. We've got small trees that
get it up into the canopy.
Can wick a fire from the ground up into the canopy.
So is it a lack of recognition that that had occurred or a lack of desire to
I think it's a collision of a lot of things, but a somewhat of an arrogance that we think we could control all of these events. And now
combined with a political
and like we need a paradigm shift. I mean, California is not going to exterminate fire, and we have to figure out how to adapt to live in a landscape where fire comes with some frequency.
KINS News and Information Time, it's 8:41.
Hey folks, flying local is buying local. And with three airlines serving five destinations, Humboldt County has more choices than ever. Fly on American, Avelo, or United Airlines. We have service to Denver, Hollywood Burbank, LAX, Phoenix, and San Francisco airports. Now's the time to book and save on that getaway. Or have friends and family fly to visit the beautiful Redwood Coast. For more information, go to flyhumboldt.org. Fly Humboldt, more flights to more destinations.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:46. We're back talking shop this morning with Yana Velikovic. Oh, what? Now you're in your defensive mode.
Well, okay.
Body language changes when the mics come on. With the backdrop of what you were saying in the last segment about how things were once forest practices started and the timber harvesting and the clear cutting, and now there are changes. With the EIRs that are down and the timber harvest plans that, if they are filed, is there a recognition, Yana, that salvage harvesting, which seems to be my magic button, is part of it, that we need to harvest a certain amount, whether it's state lands or Forest Service lands or private lands, percentages have to be or should be done in order to make the overall management more effective, more efficient, and safer?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, certainly there's a great opportunity for utilization with the, you know, the vast numbers of trees that we've seen and die as a result of the August fire, the Dixie fire. The problem is we don't have the infrastructure to even process that material.
Just getting it out isn't necessary. You can't have a huge bonfire just off I-5 somewhere and burn all this stuff.
Well, that's what if you can use it as a wood product, why wouldn't you get the highest value out of it, right?
Well, the public safety part is part of that continuum.
Right? Yeah. I think that the piece that's really interesting to me right now is there's a federal and state law called, the federal side is NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. The state law is CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. And both...
Oh, you're going to match me acronym for acronym.
Yeah, acronym for acronym. Okay, so NEPA and CEQA,
yes.
Right? So they're sort of parallel laws. And they look at environmental consequence of management actions. And what's interesting to me is that the default is a no-action alternative. You compare your project to a no-action alternative. And when you think about that, we're set up for a fundamental flaw in that the no-action alternative doesn't accommodate or consider the fact that fire needs to touch that landscape and that fire has historically touched that landscape pre those laws enacting.
So we're always
comparing against something that is a fallacy in some way, something that's entirely unachievable that we'll never see fire. And so I think we need to really rethink some of those laws to be able to be more true to what is actually happening in our
So using like a 50-year trend as the base?
No,
reference?
But to more say that the alternative is some kind of fuels treatment or prescribed fire or mechanical treatment to manage those fuels because...
At a base level,
and then your project is compared to that. And what you'll see is that probably the project is not significantly substantial once you've added in the fact that you need to manage those fuels at
Rather
some base.
Rather than just being zero.
You know, exactly. So how we think about preservation of land in a no development versus a no management framework, right?
That'd be a huge, huge shift.
It's a huge shift.
And cultural change for a lot of the staff.
Well, for all of us, I think, as a country. That's what I'm talking about in terms of paradigm shifts. We spent in 2020 more than $5 billion in California on fire suppression between federal and state resources. And what did we spend in fire prevention and fuels management and ecosystem management?
Parker.
Maybe. Something like that. So it's not all about money. I mean, it's also about that paradigm shift around thinking about how we live in a landscape that is going to experience fire in some way. And the question is, how do we create it in a way that is accommodating to us and not burning our homes down? So in the last 10 years, we've lost 43,000 structures in California.
Well, and there's an argument that is put forth that says we shouldn't have any buildings inside the woods at all. No interface. It all inlands, and we just let
I don't buy into that. I don't buy into that at all. And our recent analysis of Paradise, so we looked at single-family construction in Paradise, because basically the whole town burned down in one 12-hour period. It tells you a lot about how fire can move through a landscape and how... construction codes and standards influence home survival or don't. And what we found to be the strongest predictor of loss was the closest loss. So in other words, your survival is dependent on your neighbor's condition. So if your neighbor's home burns down, it has a high likelihood of impact on you. So what that says, though, is that density is somewhat problematic once you get ignition in smaller subdivisions.
Well, you see that in metropolitan areas, too. Building to building.
Well, exactly. And so, we densify communities for other reasons, but I think the argument for fire is not necessarily the one to do.
So is fire even in that equation?
A lot of people are making arguments that we should, we can harden the perimeter of a subdivision.
Like a moat or something like that?
Kind of, right, and create a harder bank on the outside so that it will,
protect everybody inside.
Right, and so in concept that sort of works until you get that moat breached and you get, an ember transfer into the interior of that subdivision, and then you get ignition in close density, and then you can have home-to-home spread.
Yeah, now you got fireworks going on.
Right,
yeah.
And then you've got a much more challenging situation. So how we design our communities for density and fire is something that can be done, but it has to be done thoughtfully.
It'll be interesting to see how that one plays out. It makes sense.
Right,
but
yeah.
But will the concept be embraced by planners?
I think that's part of this paradigm shift we have to think about.
All right. We'll get ready. Shift it from first to second. Here we go. Thanks for coming by.
Oh, you bet. Good to be with you.
See everybody tomorrow.